Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
Chris, I am well. I don't have a deep, cool, sick voice like you do, but I want to tell you straight up here at the beginning, I'm sorry that you have to have a sore throat to have that deep, cool voice.
As people can probably tell by the fact that my voice is extremely sexy right now, when it's usually only mostly sexy, I am sick. I'm a little under the weather this week. So Matt is probably going to be doing quite a bit of talking over the course of this episode. Matt, are there any phrases that you want me to say in like a raspier, sexier tone than I usually have while I've got this going?
Say, you've reached Matt's phone. Leave a message at the tone.
You've reached Matt's phone. Leave a message at the tone. There's a couple I want to get in while I've got this. I don't have friends. I have family.
Oh, that was very good.
That's a good one. Here's another one. One shall stand and one shall fall. One more before I move on. This one's a little more obscure, but if you like it, you're going to like it. Have a nice honeymoon.
I love that one.
Yeah, that's a good one, right? Matt, what are we going to do on this show besides having me say things in my raspy voice?
What we are going to do in our interview segment is talk to Dan Guarino, who is a business reporter in Columbus, Ohio, who wrote a book called Comic Shop, The Retail Mavericks, who gave us a new geek culture all about the rise of the direct market in comics, the rise of Diamond as the only extant comic book distributor for those comic shops, and sort of giving a year in the life of his local comic shop in Columbus, The Laughing Ogre. So we're going to talk to Dan all about that book. It's fascinating, a great read. If you have any interest in comics as a business, it is really worth checking out, really worth reading through, because I got a lot out of it and I learned a lot of stuff that I didn't know before. Like, I have a whole different view of Diamond now that I've read that book. A more positive one, weirdly enough.
Because I'm sure you have talked to me about my experience with Diamond before, but there's a lot of context to that Dan gets into in the book, which is very interesting.
And before we get to talking to Dan, Chris, we always have some business to take care of here at the top of the show, including thanking our newest supporters on Patreon. These are the folks who went to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicked in as little as $1 a month to help us keep the lights on and keep paying those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. Here are our newest Patreon supporters.
Matt, can we just say that it's actually a little unfair for these people to get me thanking them in this voice?
They timed it right, is all I have to say. Brandon Carter.
Thank you, Brandon.
The Oily Maniac.
I guess I have to say it. Thank you, The Oily Maniac.
Don.
Thanks, Don.
And Daniel.
Daniel.
If you want to be like Brandon, the Oily Maniac, Don, and Daniel, you can head over to patreon.com/warrocketajax. And as I mentioned, kick in as little as $1 a month to get stuff like ad-free episodes of the show, patron-exclusive art, which we've got to commission some of very soon, physical rewards, line-stepping privileges, bonus audio, which we just posted some of. All that stuff is available if you help us out on Patreon. So if that sounds like a cool thing that you want to do, then please go do it. Now that we have thanked our Patreon supporters, now it is time to do some checks and wrecks. Chris, in as few words as possible so that you don't ruin your throat completely, what do you have to check in with?
Well, first of all, I do want to just throw this out there. Here's a Year of the Lumberjack update for everybody. It's going well. I got my new bathrobe this week. That is also from Duluth Trading Company. It is red plaid, fully lumberjack style. There is a secret knife pocket. Stop wearing clothes that don't have secret knife pockets, I think, is my advice to everybody in 2018.
I mean, we have seriously debated whether we want to give up talking about comics anymore and just talk about knives.
I can't believe we had that entire conversation off mic. It has shaped the way I view this podcast and the way I view my life, in that it, like, I could walk away from comics tomorrow and know that Matt and I could still just talk about knives. And the thing is, we're not really knife guys.
But we could be. We could be.
We did go to the world's largest knife store. Or I did, at least. And I bought you something from it.
I've been there before.
So my transition into only comfortable flannels and plaids, and every item of clothing I own coming from this one place, is going swimmingly. The big check this week, though, is that, Matt, I have a couple of house guests. Because what's more fun when you're sick than house guests?
Other people that you could make sick.
Oh, yeah, it's the best, especially when they can then take my disease back to their home regions. No, we have some people that may be familiar to War Rocket Ajax listeners staying with us this week. Zaya Grace, formerly of Comics Alliance, is hanging out with us this week, and he is joined by former War Rocket Ajax emergency backup co-host Chris Rowling. They're both in town, and one of the great things about that is that Zaya's out from California, and he landed, and then the next day we got, and this is a shoot, 8 inches of snow. It was beautiful, powdery, packable, snowman building snow, the likes of which I don't know that I have ever seen in my life. Like, there were multiple 5 foot tall Frosty the Snowman ass snowmen outside yesterday. And it has been wonderful. And the delight on his face as he has gone through it has been made this whole visit rewarding. We've basically been snowed in, holing up here. We may end up having to do an entire bonus content on this, Matt, but the new Ellen DeGeneres television show, The Game of Games? Have you watched this madness?
I have not.
Oh, Matt, we're going to talk about it one of these days. You're not going to believe me when I explain this show to you.
Is it on Hulu?
It is on Hulu.
Okay. Maybe I'll go check it out.
If you would like to see the closest thing that human society in real life has made to the concept of murder world, I suggest you check it out. I joked about being sick and having guests, but, like, legitimately, what is more fun than, like, getting snowed in and, like, cooking food together and making hot chocolate and having, like, friends around to watch movies? Like, a very chill party that lasts, like, 3 or 4 days. It's been really good. That's what I'm up to this week. And also, I got to bundle up in my brand new robe, which I'm very, very excited about and which I highly recommend checking out. Matt, what is your check this week?
Did the robe also come from Duluth Trading Company?
The robe did, in fact, come from Duluth Trading Company.
Okay. My check is, if you listened to our gift exchange episode, Minisode, back from right after Christmas, our gift exchange that occurred at Dollywood. Maybe we should make that an annual tradition where we always exchange gifts at Dollywood.
I mean, it would be really great to just get a little bit of that cinnamon bread.
Yeah. Maybe we could just give each other strips of fabric and assemble a coat of many colors.
Hey, let me see if this works with my voice like this is. Maybe I'll dye my hair. That's a little bit of Hard Candy Christmas for you.
Very nice. Very good. Anyway, you know that Chris gifted to me an SNES Classic, and I've been playing the hell out of that thing. Probably surprising no one, I immediately replayed Super Metroid as soon as I got it connected. That's the game I made a beeline for, and I replayed. Then I started replaying Super Mario RPG, which I have not played in 20 years.
All right, this I'm genuinely curious about, because I think the last time I played through it was on an emulator, probably pre-ISB days, so maybe like 2003, so 15 years.
So it was during that like college age period where...
Yeah, where you had nothing to do but play through shitty old video games.
You downloaded some emulators and played old games all the time.
Where you could just go to a website that had... I'm about to get very real. You could just go to a website that had two sections. One was scanslated hentai, and the other was ROMs. And you had to make your choice every morning.
Yeah, and
what kind of person you wanted to be.
Yeah, and you would download a torrent of like 1,000 ROMs.
This was, I think this was even pre-torrent days for me.
Yeah, it may have been like you got on Kazaa and got your 1,000 ROMs. And like maybe like 500 of those were regular games. And then the other 500 were like these weird ass ROM hacks.
Oh man. Hey, what Patreon goal for us to play? Like, I know that like a lot of people do this, but we don't do it. Like, just play some ROM hacks together.
Problem with most ROM hacks is they're broken and often like racist.
And you're frequently just extremely racist.
Yeah. The SNES Classic does not have that problem. And I've been replaying Super Mario RPG. It is as fun and good as I remember it being. It is shorter than I remember it being. I remember it being one of like a long ass RPG when I was, you know, 14. Compared to like what an RPG is on the PS4, it's, you know, relatively contained and short. The one thing I completely forgot from that game is there's a part where you go through like a secret series of pipes and you end up on this island of Yoshis.
Mm-hmm.
You find standard issue Green Yoshi. You talk to him. He says, "Jump on my back and I'll translate Yoshi language to you for all the other Yoshis." So you go around and you talk to all the other Yoshis. They talk about how they love racing, but they can't race because this one Yoshi among them has taken over the racetrack and he can't be beaten and he won't race. Or he won't let anybody else race until he's beaten. This character's name is Boshi.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the Wario of Yoshis. I looked him up. If you go to like the Mario Wiki, you'll find that in Japan, Boshi was not called Boshi. He was called Washi. So he has the same naming convention as Wario and Waluigi. He wears sunglasses. He's the only Yoshi who does not wear shoes. Oh, he's got like a spiked collar. So the only game where the Wario version of Yoshi appears is Super Mario RPG. And that is because all the characters who originally appeared in Super Mario RPG exist in some legal gray area where Squaresoft owns a big chunk of their IP. So Nintendo can't use them. Nintendo can't use Geno. Nintendo can't use Mallow. They can't use Smithy. They can't use any of the like Super Mario RPG original characters, including Boshi.
Matt, can I ask you a quick question?
Please do.
Are you telling me that Geno, the puppet who came to life and has laser beam hands, and Mallow, little marshmallow cloud boy, are... In if we're going to literalize idea space in the way that, say, an Alan Moore would.
Sure.
They're hanging out with our boy Access.
Yeah. Yeah. They're hanging out with Access and all the Amalgam characters.
There's your motherfucking million-dollar idea crossover, everybody.
All the legal gray area characters who exist in a limbo.
Let's get all access to that shit.
Yeah. Boshi, all up in it. So anyway, I tweeted about it, but I wanted to talk out loud on a podcast about Boshi, Yoshi's Wario.
Oh, man. See, maybe we can do an every video game character ever. Like, when we're done with Panel President at the end of the year. Because I think this is going to be the last year of Panel President. I'm predicting that now.
We're going to keep getting lists, but okay.
Maybe we start a new list and we start with, like, I guess Mario, like, would be like our kind of gold standard, our popcorn or our Batman Year One, as the case may be.
Sure.
And then who would be our bottom tier character
in video games?
Yeah. Who would be the identity crisis / I don't even remember who we started with, who was bad on the panel president list, because it got real bad real quick over there.
I don't know. I can't think of any, like, really, really actively bad characters, even though I know they exist.
Duke Nukem?
I mean,
Duke Nukem's pretty fucking bad.
Duke Nukem's pretty bad, yeah. For whatever reason, what I immediately jumped to was Bubsy.
Bubsy? Did I? Look, I've been on a lot of quill-based substances lately. Did I dream it, or did Bubsy have, like, a resurgence in late 2017?
There was a remake of the original Bubsy that came out.
Okay. You know what it should be? It should be Mario and Sonic. And that's where we start.
Man, burn.
Anyway, look, if this is something you're interested in, write us. Back the Patreon, because we'll do it. If we can quit our jobs and just devote our lives to these ranking podcasts, I'll do it.
All right. That's it for our checks. Chris, let's make some recommendations. Oh, Matt,
real quick. Just wanted to you touched on this a little bit. Mario RPG, does it hold up? Because I've been worried about revisiting it, because I do love that game.
It does hold up. It does.
Okay.
All right, let's make some recommendations. Chris, what do you have to recommend?
My recommendation is actually going to be very appropriate, given my current state and my voice. Matt, are you familiar with the board game Pandemic?
I am indeed, yes.
Pandemic is a super, super fun board game about trying to cure viruses. It's very easy to lose, which makes it very fun and also incredibly depressing. And I mostly played the original Pandemic to kill time when I was extremely depressed a couple years ago, just to pull back the curtain on this. But last year for Christmas, David Uzumeri gave Aiden and I Pandemic Legacy. If you don't know what a legacy game is, it is a game that doesn't reset at the end, a board game. You permanently change the board game as you play it. So there is a limited number of times you can play it, because you're generally playing through a campaign, but you do things like tear up cards or mark the board with a marker or apply stickers to things. There's a Risk legacy. There's a game called Seafall that's about pirates that I have not played. But because we really liked the original Pandemic, we had heard that Pandemic Legacy was really good. We held off on playing it for a very long time because we didn't really have anyone local who we could get together with and play through these, you know, 12 to 24 sessions of Pandemic Legacy. But then I was told, I think on the show even, I mentioned it, and people wrote in and said, oh, no, it's actually very workable with two players. So on New Year's Eve, Aiden and I busted out Pandemic Legacy Season 1. And it is the single best board game I have ever played.
Hmm.
The design of it is incredible. The way that it manipulates the players, the way that it flows, the story that it tells, the way that the game changes in ways that are always new and shocking and exciting. Unbelievably good. My favorite design choice in that first season of Pandemic Legacy is the, and this is not a spoiler, I guess it's kind of a spoiler, but it's the first thing you do when you open the box. So take that before you hit the skip button. When you first open the box, the first thing it makes you do is it says, hey, take this sticker and put it on package number 8, because there are 8 packages, like little sealed cardboard boxes that you are asked to open up. And it tells you to take a sticker and put it on package number 8. And the sticker says, if you lose 4 games in a row, open this package. So the first thing the game does is teach you, A, that there are permanent changes that you're going to be making by applying stickers, mm-hmm. that there are these packages that you are going to be opening when you hit certain conditions, that you can lose games and still progress, but it also tells you, it also puts a consequence on you, like, above your head at the start, before you get the board out of the box, before you have, you know, unwrap the cards, as you're reading through the rule book, it gives you a threat. That's fucking rad. Pandemic Legacy Season 1 is incredible. For Christmas this year, David Uzumeri bought us Pandemic Legacy Season 2. And so we've been waiting for Chris and Zaya to get here to play that. It is also, so far, pretty fucking amazing. And the incredible thing is how different it is, both from regular Pandemic and from Season 1, and how it, like, changes what you're used to from playing Pandemic and from playing this very intense board game. You no longer recognize what it is that you're doing, because it changes it just enough while still recognizably being the same game. In short, it takes a really well-designed board game, because Pandemic has a very simple and very, very fun design, and makes it play like a video game, with different abilities, with unlocks, with level progression, with essentially a world map that changes, like a literal world map. They're two completely different games. I would highly suggest starting with Pandemic Legacy Season 1. I would actually, if you've never played any of them, get regular Pandemic and play it and see if you like that. But absolutely, if you want to experience like one of the most thrilling and rewarding board games that has eclipsed Betrayal at the House on the Hill, for me, by far, get this game and play it. It's amazing.
Do you have Pandemic Legacy Blue or Red?
We got the blue version of Season 1, and as far as I know, the only thing that is different is the box color. The contents and the gameplay are the exact same. They did it with Season 2 as well. Like, there's a yellow and black version. And again, I haven't looked because I didn't really want to spoil anything about it, but as far as I know, it is the same game. But Matt, you should get this game.
Somebody asked on Amazon, what's the difference between the red and the blue board games? The answer is, once you start playing the game, you end up making permanent changes to the game unique to that box, which is why having different colored games makes sense if you decide to play more than one game of Legacy and want to easily differentiate the games.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
So there you go. There you go.
And I will say this, like, having played through the entirety of Pandemic Legacy Season 1 and getting a good maybe 20 sessions out of it, it is absolutely worth the price, because it is essentially the price of a video game.
Yeah.
But it is absolutely worth the price. And Matt, I would play it again, but only with people who hadn't played it, and I would keep my mouth shut the entire time about what we could expect. So highly recommended. If you have a gaming group, or if you have even just a friend or partner who enjoys video games, jump on this thing. It's amazing. Matt, what is your check this week, or rec this week?
My rec, it's rare that we just recommend a single song, but I have been in the position of just hitting replay on this song over and over and over again for the past week. I love it, and it is part of an ongoing music trend that I am very pleased about. The song is called After the Storm. It's by Kali Yukis, featuring Bootsy Collins and Tyler, the Creator. And it is the true return of funk music. I even tweeted about it earlier this week, where I was like, let's all celebrate the return of funk music while the world collapses around us. Because I just can't stop listening to this song. It is so, so super good. If you want to just go listen to it, it's on YouTube. You can just search After the Storm, and there it is, and you can play the song, and it sounds great. And I say it's part of the trend because I feel like the R&B that existed in the 2010s up to now, you know, has all kind of had the same sort of sound, almost like, it's all been almost like kind of like Latin flavored R&B, which there's nothing wrong with, but I've always been like a huge, huge funk music fan. If you caught me driving around in my Jeep Cherokee Classic when I was 17, you would have definitely caught me listening to my Millennium Funk Party CD, a CD that I wore out It may be the only CD that I have ever played so much that it is that I wore it out. And so I love that kind of music. After the Storm by Kali Uchis is one of those. Also, sub wreck within this wreck, the entire Thundercat album Drunk that came out last year has a really great, really cool, funky sound that I think sort of feeds into this song. And I really deeply hope that this trend continues in music where like funk is a thing again, because like good new funk music has not been a thing, and that it is a thing now is very exciting to me.
I am really glad that it is finally time to return your original nickname, Matt Greasy Nasty Funk Wilson.
That's right. Matt Slap Bass Wilson. You know me. So that's my recommendation. Go listen to After the Storm by Kali Uchis. It's super, super good.
Let's talk about some comics, Slap Bass.
Boop, de, boop, boop. Let's do it. Chris, we haven't talked about Mage, the Hero Denied, in a little while. Fifth issue came out this week. It's still very good. It's a different kind of story.
Yeah, guess what? This book fucking rules, though. Guess what? This book that we've been waiting for 15 years is the shit. Here's the thing that I wanted to talk about this one. I really enjoy the plot, and I really enjoy the way that it is moving in interesting ways. There's kind of an unexpected year jump between the end of the last issue and the beginning of this one. And I love that it does that because in the last issue, Kevin Matchstick's son found out about Kevin Matchstick being the Pendragon and like all the monster hunting stuff that he does. But we, as readers, we know about all that stuff. We know the premise of the book, so we don't have to go through having it explained. So Matt Wagner just skips ahead a year and is like, yeah, all this is established. We're good. It starts with a flashback toward the end of The Hero Denied, or The Hero Defined. But one thing that I really am ending up liking about this book a lot, and it's something that we talked about when we read that first issue and when we read the Zero issue, it actually is a 90s period piece for now.
Yeah.
Because we see, and it never tells you what year it's set in, but there's like, we talked about the guy in the Zero issue who talks all weird.
And has a Walkman. Yeah.
And how we didn't know if that was just Matt Wagner being a, you know, weird old dude or if that was intentional. But over the course of the first five issues of the series, we've seen Kevin Matchstick's kid watching Dragon Ball Z in the afternoon on a CRT TV.
Yeah.
Reading an Animorphs book and catching an episode of Rocko's Modern Life. And I love that. Oh, and Kevin Matchstick drives a mid-90s new Beetle.
Mm-hmm.
I love that is how he's setting the time, because he does it in this issue too. Like when we get to that flashback, it's very obviously a flashback because of the way he draws Kevin Matchstick's hair and his earring, the way that things are moving in the book. And I'm wondering, since we got like a year gap between 4 and 5, and this series is still slated to run 15 issues, if we might end up like catching up to 2017, 2018 over the course of the series. If we don't, that's fine. But if we do, that's a pretty cool way to do it.
That would sort of go along with the way that this story is being told, in that this book, like, it's called The Hero Denied, because in this, Kevin Matchstick is a literal reluctant hero.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of doesn't want to do this anymore. Like, even when he meets up with an old friend and they hear about a monster around the corner and they think about, you know, maybe we're going to go check out what this monster is. And then it ends on a cliffhanger. The story ends on a cliffhanger when they actually see what monster they have encountered. But, like, all of the beginning of the book is him complaining about having to walk through a sewer. You know, like he kind of doesn't want to be doing this.
It's a really interesting look at the different times in a person's life, you know, because the not so secret secret to Mage is that it's slightly autobiographical in that Kevin Matchstick is visually and personality wise based on Matt Wagner himself. Joe Fat is Joe Matt. Kirby Hero is Bernie Moreau. Jeff Loeb shows up at one point in this book. And I really like the idea that, you know, as a younger man, Matt Wagner was willing to walk through shit while complaining about it the entire time. And now, as an older man, he just wants to, like, just wants to have a pizza with his friend, but still can't resist the allure of quite literally going back to this heroic story.
Yeah.
Which I think for a Mage book that's coming back, getting something that feels a lot like the struggle of a comics creator returning to his story of, you know, his creator-owned superhero book after 15 years is a really interesting setup.
Yeah, I'm digging this book a lot, even though it's not necessarily the book I expected.
It's not at all the book I expected, but in these first five issues, I think it has been like very recognizably a Mage story. You know, like we got a big old boss fight last month. So yeah. Lots of fun stuff.
Next up, we're going to talk about the first number one issue in DC's New Age of Heroes line. Damage.
Now, Matt, this is not about Damage from the 90s.
It is not that Damage.
What's your Damage?
Good question. This is a new Damage. He's basically a military bioweapon. Like the military chose this lead character, Ethan, to be basically a Hulk-like figure. I don't know, like a government-created weapon, so whatever character analog you want to use for that. There's a rival soldier who wanted to be Damage but didn't get that appellation. And then there's the added aspect of it where he can only stay Damage for an hour. Here's my best description of this comic book. It's basically like DC doing its own Image comics. That's what it feels like. This feels like an Image Comics number one. The artist is credited first. Tony Daniel is credited first in the credits. Robert Venditti, the writer, is credited second. It's very art driven. And I will say, like, Tony Daniel, like, we've complained about Tony Daniel's art in the past in like Batman RIP and mostly on the Morrison Batman stuff. His art in this is extremely dynamic and does what it does, you know, like it is telling the story it wants to tell, but like, there's not a lot of there. It's this very quick read with like some big action and this sort of like pretty derivative character with a couple new aspects to it. And everything about it reminded me of an Image Comics number one from 1991. It's just that it's happening within DC Comics. Instead of artists breaking off to do their own comics, like start their own company, DC just started its own artist-focused line within DC Comics. I hesitate to say that it's good, but it's really fascinating.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what else is in this new line of books.
This is the same line that's gonna give us the Terrifics, which I'm really excited about. I think that's maybe our most highly anticipated book of 2017 or 2018.
Certainly currently. It's also like, at least at this point, the one that's most closely tied into like DC. It's got like recognizable DC characters in it in a way that, well, I guess the new Challengers is obviously like a pretty clear DC thing, but the one that is most like clearly a DC Comics book is the Terrifics, which I am very excited about. But Damage is a real interesting thing. I want to see what some of these other series are going to do, for sure.
These all seem like a bunch of DC books that are DC riffing on Marvel properties.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you know, historically, DC has done quite a bit. That's how we got New Teen Titans. Doing it with like a very artist-focused way, and the weird little books that we're getting seem, at the very least, very interesting.
We're going to wrap up by talking about Avengers number 676. We talked about 675 last week. Chris, I haven't read this one yet, so you got to tell me what's going on now.
Hey, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how we got triumphed last week?
We did get triumphed, yes.
Remember how we got either triumphed or sentried last week?
Or maybe both.
Yeah, we get triumphed and sentried this week. This week, we get we actually find out who the new old character is. Her name is Voyager. Her real name is Valerie Vector, which I think is very fun.
Uh-huh.
But her whole deal is that she was removed from reality in Avengers number 70, which is a Roy Thomas joint, and that's where the Squadron Sinister fights the Avengers. So not only is she removed from reality, she's also facing a guy, the member of the Squadron Sinister that she fights, is another new old character, and his name is Victory the Electromagnetic Man. Which is, here's the funniest thing. You know how the Squadron Sinister, aka the Squadron Supreme, they're all Justice League guys. Right, they're all Justice League analogs. Hyperion is Superman, Nighthawk is Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah, this motherfucker just looks like Triumph. He literally, Matt, you will not believe it, he just looks like Triumph. It's hilarious. He is Triumph, but with like the Gambit head sock.
Hilarious.
It's bananas. And here's the, like, I want you to do me a favor. If you do not believe me, Google Triumph comics and look at this guy's costume. It's literally the same costume. They're fucking with us at this point. They, also the company that occasionally employs me to write comics, but I am delighted by this.
You are not kidding. They are almost exactly the same costume.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, dude. But I find that absolutely delightful. We talked about being able to pick out who's writing what in these bits. This issue feels very Al Ewing heavy to me.
Yeah.
And again, I have no information on whether that is the case or not, but it certainly reads like that. And is bananas in a way that I really appreciate.
I gotta say, the name Victory the Electromagnetic Man is really good.
It's very good.
Like, it's very believably, you know, late Silver Age Avengers.
Here's my favorite thing about this book. And this is a very subtle thing. And honestly, regardless of what you feel about Avengers No Surrender and the sort of weekly approach to Avengers comics, I genuinely love and appreciate the fact that they are using what should be like the highest possible tier Marvel book by a roster of genuinely great creators. You know, once again, we've got Pepe Larraz and David Curiel doing the art, Corey Petit doing letters. They are doing weird comic stuff, like, say, throwing out a reference to Triumph from the 90s. But I think my favorite thing about Voyager is that the way they incorporate her into the old Avengers stories is that she – and they do this in the one that references Avengers 58. Her dialogue is the captions. She's the one who says, "You'd know even an android can cry," which is a caption in that book.
Yeah.
In Voyager's case, it's dialogue that she says out loud. I love the idea of the missing Marvel character who's the fucking omniscient narrator. That's fucking brilliant.
That's
like weird Morrison shit.
That's smarter than anything they ever did with the Sentry. I'll say that much.
Or Triumph.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's like going to be a bit or that's going to be a gimmick. Or honestly, I'm not even familiar enough with the other comics reference. Because again, I'm not a huge Avengers guy. I've just seen that panel of the Vision crying 1 million times because I'm on the internet. And I love that they incorporated that. I think this book is turning out to be a huge amount of fun. Much like Metal, I feel like it's the kind of fun that you and I are going to respond to, and maybe other people won't.
Yeah, that's fair.
Y'all, we got Sentried and Triumphed this week.
Sentried and Triumphed. And with that, I think that's going to wrap up our comics segment. Which means, Chris, it's time for us to talk to Dan Guarino about his new book, all about comic shops. It's going to be fun. So let's talk to him.
Let's do that thing. Joining us for the program this week, we're very excited to welcome someone to the show who is in a field that we do not usually talk to, but we're pretty excited about it. We have Dan Guarino here to talk about his new book, Comic Shop, The Retail Mavericks Who Gave Us a New Geek Culture. Dan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Chris.
Dan, you and I have both been reporters. We were reporters who are comic fans. You come from the world of business reporting. I get the sense from the book that you are definitely a comics fan, but I really would love to know what brought about this desire to write an entire book about the comics direct market and what inspired you to make that, you know, sort of this longer form project in addition to the regular day-to-day business reporting that you do.
In my day job, I'm a business reporter for a daily newspaper in Columbus, Ohio. I've been a comics reader for as long as I can read. I found in being a business writer that I noticed things about comic shops that a typical customer might not notice. I noticed that this was a kind of business that is not like other businesses. It's not even like other retail businesses in a lot of different ways. And I just found that fascinating. And so I wanted to read more about it. And I found when I wanted to find out how this all started, I wanted to find out what some of the best shops were, what the different types of shops are. There just wasn't a lot out there. It's almost a comes across as a cliche, but it was like it was a book I wanted to read and it didn't exist. So and as a reporting project, you can't get much more fun than traveling to a whole bunch of comic shops and talking to a bunch of retailers past and present. It's one of those things where I again to spout a cliche, but it's one of those things that I would do for free. It was just a lot of fun, and it allowed me to use a lot of the business reporting muscles that I've got, but just in a different way. It was a really fun change of pace.
I want to get into the travel and how you found your sources for this book, because the choices that you make in here, as far as like the comic shops that you go to, the people that you interview, and how you get some of the background on not only comics shops, but comics distribution is really interesting. And I want to get into that. But before I do, I want to talk a little bit about just the uniqueness of comics as a business generally, because there are a couple things early on in the book that you say, or you quote people as saying, which I never really thought about before, but that are eminently true. One of them being that comics is maybe the only type of retail business where there are no national chains for sales. I mean, there are comics sold in national bookstore chains, but like strictly direct market retail, like at best, there are like handfuls of local chains with, you know, maybe at a maximum of a dozen locations, but there's no Starbucks for comics. There's no Sam Goody for comics.
It's a model that resists being a chain, because the best shops, what they do is they are highly customized to their local audiences. And if you try to do that as a chain, you reach a point where you just don't, you can't pull it off on a large scale. And you look at, it was not strictly a comic shop, but you look at Hastings, and there were many things wrong with that business. But trying to do this kind of mini comic shop within a larger chain store, it's just a financial disaster, because so much of operating a successful comic shop is being able to order within a really, really close number of what your actual sales are going to be. And that's really, really hard.
Speaking of financial disasters, another, I think this is a quote from somebody early on in the book, but you, basically very early on, you say something to the effect of, you're definitely better off financially starting a Subway franchise than starting a comic shop.
Yep. And it's funny that that actually looks less true now. It's like Subway's travails as a chain are becoming more and more evident. I think I'd have to go back and look at whether this was pre-Jared's problems or not. But yeah, at the time that person said that, I think Subway was this example of this kind of business anyone could start and probably make a buck. But yeah, it's there are lots of other franchise-type businesses that have much closer to a – you know, there's no guarantees, but are much closer to a reliable source of income. If you're in the comics business, you're just signing up for this level of instability that for all but a few people, all but a few entrepreneurs, is really, really difficult to live with. The good thing is that those that can do it well are really, really good. And you look at the ones who've been in business a long time and have really kind of mastered this model. But it's not for everybody. And it's people who have the risk tolerance and are smart enough to do a comic shop really well could do a lot of other things, you know. And so it's nobody's. I heard over and over again people say that they aren't doing this for the money, because the best comics retailers have the wherewithal to do a lot of other things.
So you don't do a lot of editorializing in the book. It's mostly straight reporting with a handful of like your own personal stories about things that happened in the course of your reporting. But I wonder, in all your conversations with all these comic shop owners and all your travels to all these different stores, what is it strictly just a love of the medium that brought these people into this business? Because there's some stuff in the book about like the speculation mm-hmm. market or the collector's market, and how like those some collectors have no interest in comics themselves. They just want to make an investment. But as for the shop owners, do you just get that they like this is the thing they're passionate about? They couldn't open any other kind of store.
Even those stores that really emphasize the kind of collectible element and emphasize back issues and that side of comics retail, Even they have an intense passion for the medium. I mean, you look at the example that comes to mind is Chuck Rosansky, who is one of these guys. There are several people in the book that if they were fictional characters, if they were in a work of fiction, you would say that they were unrealistic. And Chuck is one of those guys.
Chuck Rosansky is the founder of Mile High Comics.
Exactly, Mile High Comics. And he's so intensely passionate about the medium. He's one of the more kind of ebullient and lovers of the business who have been in it for a long time. There are others who have been in it for a long time and are clearly a little bit burnt out, even though they still have a good store. But they don't really, you know, they don't necessarily like to read comics anymore I think almost across the board, if you're a comics retailer who really doesn't like comics, you're in trouble, because so much of what makes a good shop is, well, two things. One is ordering the right mix of stuff for the people coming in the door. But then there's this second element, which is getting more people to come in the door and expanding the amount of stuff through recommendations or through people finding stuff in the store, getting your existing customer base to get more stuff. And somebody who really loves the medium and reads a lot of the stuff in the store is going to be good at seeing that their customer reads this or that and recommending something else. And it's going to be good at maybe getting the significant other or the spouse that's there in the store to become a comics reader too. And just things like that are really difficult to pull off if you just don't like the stuff. I think there are a lot of other businesses where the people who are doing it, they care to a certain extent, but it's a job. And that's not the case. Otherwise, the long hours, just the level of risk would just be – it'd be untenable if not for the fact that they love what they're doing.
To get into the content of the book itself a little bit more, I kind of see it as three books. There's kind of three narratives in there. There's a pretty comprehensive history of direct market comics retail, and by virtue of that, comics distribution, leading to the rise of Diamond. There's what you might call an extended profile of your hometown comic shop in Columbus, Ohio, mm-hmm. The Laughing Ogre. And then there's like almost like a Zagat's guide for comic shops in the last, 40, 50 pages or so, listing, all these different comic shops that you visited around the country, including, before I left there, my old hometown comic shop, Chicago Comics.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
I love that store. But I wonder which one of those ideas came first, or if you just from the beginning wanted to do all three, or if one sort of sprung up by virtue of doing the others, or just how that mix sort of came about.
So you are absolutely correct in identifying the kind of three books within this book. The kind of the pitch for the book and the reason the book exists is the present day narrative. And the present day narrative is a year in the life in the comics business from summer of 2015 to summer of 2016. So that's the year of Convergence from DC. It's the year of Secret Wars. It's a year of ups and downs. And just to make it so that so you had recurring characters and you had people you could get to know and just feel grounded in that exploration of the year. I chose to make kind of the home base for that narrative, The Laughing Ogre, which is my local store in Columbus. So every present day chapter starts at The Laughing Ogre. Sometimes you're only there for like a page and then you kind of go off to other stores or other situations. That's kind of one chunk. And then in addition to that, there's the stuff about the history of the business. Now, the stuff about the history of the business is, I don't think there's a super large audience for that. I think that having that stuff folded into something that's about contemporary comic shops made it so that maybe people interested in comic shops as a business or who love their local comic shop will read. And then the history stuff I think is really interesting, but I'm kind of trying to stealth get that stuff in there as well. That was a lot of why I wanted to write this, because there wasn't a lot of that stuff. There have been a couple long magazine articles and they've been written in fan publications, but a lot of that stuff had never been written in this form before. So a lot of that was the stuff that I really it took a huge share of the energy was on the sections about the history of the business. And a lot of that stuff was kind of using the degree of difficulty was a lot higher. And then there's that final section, which is the store profiles. So one of the things I wanted to do was I wanted to go to a whole bunch of stores. I enjoy visiting comic shops. When I'm in a city, I visit the comic shop or a couple comic shops. And there was no way I could just fold them into the main story because there were just too many of them without it becoming this kind of, without it becoming just kind of disorganized. We're constantly shifting to a different place or you have all these different voices from different parts of the country in the US and Canada. I decided early on to do the kind of the brief profiles in the back because there was talking to all these store owners and being in these stores really informed what the whole book is about, kind of why comic shops are something that are interesting and that people should know about, and kind of what's really going on in the current comics market. The people who, and the situations that told me about that were from all those stores, even though they're not necessarily in the main part of the book. There's a little bit here and there. Like, I think I quote Shelton Drum from Heroes Aren't Hard to Find maybe twice in the main narrative, but that's a great store that has this, an interesting history, for example. So then these three different elements I kind of put them all together, and at no point in the publishing process did anyone say, let's not do it that way. So whether it works, I guess, is debatable, but it seemed somewhat natural to put them together in this way.
It's interesting that you say that the history stuff had to kind of like stealthily be added to the book, because as much as I liked the profile stuff about, you know, the effects of convergence on a comic shop, convergence and Secret Wars, the history stuff absolutely fascinated me and struck me as something that you never see in books about comics. You always see books about comics as an art form. Very rarely do you see books about comics as a business. And you rarely see books about these particular figures that you choose as points of focus throughout the book. Phil Suling is obviously one of them, one of the pioneers of comic conventions, as well as the architect of direct market comic sales. Yeah. And then also Carol Kalish, who made it possible through working at Marvel for direct sales to happen. These are two people that you never hear about in the, you know, the comics bubble that we live in, you know, the comics internet that's constantly focused on writers, artists, to some degree, editors and publishers, but never, you know, you hear about Diamond as a sort of this monolithic entity, but you never hear about like these particular kinds of figures that are so pivotal to comics being what they are now.
And also just how we got to this point with the Diamond, you know, with the Diamond monopoly on, at least in terms of distribution with the major publishers. I see on the comics internet this perpetual grousing about Diamond and the direct market and this current system. What's interesting to me, having looked so much at how we got here, is that a lot of these complaints are not new. I mean, even before there was a Diamond monopoly, there were lots of people who thought that the distribution system was just fundamentally flawed, and that the non-returnability, this non-returnable ordering model, where if you order 10 copies or whatever, you keep them regardless of how many you sell. You can't return them for credit. This concern that the business was about to end and that the distribution system was fundamentally flawed has basically been existed in one form or another for decades. It's interesting that a lot of the companies and the people who are often perceived as, I don't want to say villains because that's almost too simplistic, but I think in the business, when you look at kind of how they got there and how this all came to be, it's a much more nuanced story. And it all comes out of this intense competition with, in the distribution business. There was this time where there were a whole bunch of distributors, and they were fighting like crazy to gain market. And now there's just one, and it's really interesting how we got there. One of the more interesting interviews I did was with Steve Jeppy of Diamond. If you talk to retailers, particularly retailers who've been in the business a long time, he is incredibly well regarded by guys like Jim Hanley and guys who've been around the business for a while. And if you talk to more recent retailers, if you talk to somebody who's been in business for 5 or 6 years, you know, you talk about Diamond and they just cringe, and they, you know, and it's just it's fascinating how we've kind of gotten to where we are. And yeah, they're right. There's just so little awareness of why it is that things are the way that they are.
I am guilty of that. I always knew that Diamond was the distributor of comics. I maybe had some basic awareness that like Capital City existed before you know, before the Marvel bankruptcy changed everything. But I really have only kind of known that Diamond was there, and I never knew why, you know. And one thing your book does is explain the why. Explain, you know, why competitors would choose to, when they had to sell, would choose to sell to Steve Jeppy because they trusted him, right?
Yep. For the most part, these guys didn't trust each other, with a couple notable exceptions. There were, this was a business where there were people who were viewed as good guys and trustworthy guys. And I say guys because they almost all were guys. There were definitely women in the business, but especially among owners of distributors, it was mostly men. It was just kind of basic kind of business 101. People who would, you know, when you do a deal with somebody, you want a person who sold their business to you to go and tell all their friends that this was a good deal, that this person treated you right. And because every single deal is an advertisement for the next deal. And you don't want that person who just bought your company, you know, you don't want them to be such a jerk that you go and tell everyone that you shouldn't deal with this person. One of the reasons that Diamond grew was that Steve Jeppy was just a really skilled deal maker. And there's this interesting dynamic with Bud Plant. Bud Plant is a guy who's done so many things in the comics business. But one of the things he did is he owned one of the biggest distributors in the country. He also was co-owner of Comics and Comics, the chain of stores in the Bay Area. He also has a mail order comics business that's still operating today. But at one time, Bud Plant's distributor was the third largest distributor in the country. Diamond and Capital City were the two largest, depending on how you measure it. When Bud Plant sold his business, he sold it to Diamond and not Capital City. And that was the event that made it so that when the business went crazy in the mid-90s, Diamond had a national network of warehouses, and Diamond was equipped to be the monopoly. It would have gone down differently if that one deal had happened differently. And it's like it's these other guys whose names are certainly known in the comics business, but are not necessarily, it's not necessarily understood how what they did made it so that so many of the things we enjoy today are happening. In Bud Plant's case, you know, he helped to popularize selling a lot of foreign material in the U.S. He helped. He did a bunch of different things, and also was this kind of key player in distribution for a long time.
Longtime Ajax listeners will know that I worked in a comic book store for about 7 years, and my experience with that was that I felt like there was a pretty hard line, and this is something that you touched on earlier, between people like me, who I was, you know, very focused on comics as an art form. I read comics all the time. I was reading, you know, 80 to 100 titles a month, keeping up with everything so that I can make recommendations, but also because, you know, I love comics, back issues and current titles alike. But there would be, like, most of the people on the business side of things I would encounter, like, were very disconnected from what was going on in the books, like in terms of story, in terms of like actual enjoyment of the medium, as far as anything other than like what customers were reading, what was spiking sales. And I know that there are exceptions to that. I think Mike Sterling in California is a guy that Matt and I know who keeps up and is also like pretty good on the business side. But I've always had it in my head, from my experience, that there is this hard dividing line between enjoyment of comics as a reader or as a creative and having any kind of business sense whatsoever. And I'm wondering if that's just more reflective of me than it is of anything that's actually going on in the business.
Well, I've heard over and over again store owners say that the time commitment and the stress of running a business makes it so that they don't read as much stuff as they do, and they kind of at times will get out of touch with what's out there. At the same time, there are retailers like, well, right in Columbus, at Laughing Ogre, the manager, Gib Bickle, if you go into the store on Tuesdays, he's got around the time they're closing, he's got this big stack of all the number ones of new series that he takes home on Tuesday night so that he's read them and just kind of can make recommendations to customers when the new comics come out on Wednesday. There are other retailers that make a point of just, you know, they still read like crazy. They still can talk about and get excited about a new title or a relatively new creator. So, but yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of what you're saying. I mean, if you've been in this business for say 25 years and you've owned a company that you owned a store, at times the continuity and this hot new artist, whether or not you're someone who's reading the mainstream stuff or if you're someone who's more into art comics or you've seen these kind of cycles over the years where it's like you just know that, you know, the new hot thing in 1987 turned out to just kind of came and went. You know you're kind of maybe a little bit jaded and maybe more reluctant to just jump onto whatever seems to be going through this, you know, happens to be popular this particular season. And I think the good retailers know that, you know, or they can spot it in themselves. And, you know, what you generally want to do then is make sure you've hired staff that reads the heck out of things, that is really up to date on what's good and what's new, and also have a really diverse staff, a staff with diverse tastes, you know, so that your customers know that, you know, at that shop, you know, there's one particular employee that's tastes are really in line with yours and can make recommendations. And just about any customer, you know, there's somebody who's on the same wavelength. There's someone on staff who's on the same wavelength. It's just tough. I don't know how these guys have any time to read. I mean, the hours are insane. It's almost like car dealers have crazy hours too. But I think comic shop owners and managers might be about the worst I've ever seen.
I get the sense at every level of the industry, that's the case. Like, as you're building up to your interview with Steve Jeppy, you talk about how he's semi-retired and now he only works 60 hours a week.
The way that you become successful as an entrepreneur, and at some level, all of these businesses were small businesses at one time, and a lot of them are still technically small businesses in terms of just the number of employees and the number, you know, the sale, annual sales. Is you just you kind of do everything. You can delegate some things, but at a lot of shops, that owner is, you know, is not only the chief salesperson recommending stuff and ringing people up at the register, but they're also, you know, the plumber fixing the toilet, and they're fixing the electrical fixtures, and they're nailing shelves, and, you know, there's this also this kind of jack of all trades quality that also is super, super time consuming. You know, where stores will, you know, a retailer will work 6 days a week and then on Sunday come in super early before you open to paint, you know, and just stuff like that. It's news reporters have a difficult schedule and it can be really cool. But when I look at what comics retailers do, and the fact that this is taking place in this environment that's so stressful, where your viability as a business depends on whether or not the next, you know, whether or not Marvel can produce a hit in 2018 or not, or hopefully a couple of hits in 2018. I don't know how they do it, and also how they do it and keep such a sunny attitude. Because the one thing about these guys is they're, with some exceptions, they're a lot of fun. They're fun to hang out with. They're fun to talk to. It was fun to get to know them.
I'm sure they have to have developed a certain kind of persona if they're dealing with customers on a day-to-day basis. But I wonder, I have one more question about Diamond, because I find the Diamond stuff just like beyond fascinating, and how we got from all those distributors, all those regional distributors to Diamond. But, you know, if you were to ask any of those comic shop owners you talk to about Diamond, I mean, you touched on this a little bit about like the people who've been around longer seem to have a warmer feeling about Diamond, and maybe the newer ones tend to grouse a little more. But I also think, and you can confirm or deny this, maybe depending on the day, you might get a different reaction. Like on a Friday, you might hear him say, "Diamond's pretty good." But on a Tuesday, when the shipment is supposed to be coming in and they're short on some stuff or some stuff got damaged or something like that, you might get a different answer.
Well, this is what happens when most stores are getting more than 3/4 of their product from one distributor. And that one distributor is sending all of this stuff from, I think, God, is it two warehouses? It's crazy that the system doesn't down more often than it does. But it's really true that there is a generational thing among retailers. Like I did an event in California in early November at Joe Field's store in Flying Colors Comics, which is just west of Oakland. And Brian Hibbs was there, and Joe Field, and Bud Plant, and a bunch of great retailers, and a bunch of others. Afterwards, this subject came up. I was saying that one of the things I was really surprised at was how sympathetic Diamond seemed once I knew some of the kind of the business context for kind of how they kind of grew. And Brian and Joe were saying, no, that's not surprising at all. That's just, you know, that's just the reality of the business as they saw it, as they were coming up through the business. And in the book, I quote Joe Field saying that basically Diamond has an impossible job, you know. And it's like, I hate to sound like an apologist for Diamond, because there are lots of legitimate grievances that people have, but the question that I often ask when I hear people talking about the many real shortcomings of the current system is, what do you replace it with, and what does that transition look like? And how do you have a transition that is not an absolute crisis? And it just seems like, and I comment this as a fan, but also as a business writer. Like, I covered the auto bailout in the recession, the most recent recession, and you see the kind of this kind of chaos that transforms businesses is brutal. It puts a lot of people out of business. It's in the comics business, growing in a lot of ways by several different important measures for a while now. This last year was the first time that the sales were down in a while. It's funny, if you talk to enough, and this is just kind of an issue with reporters, but you know, if you talk to all sides and you go way back and you try to understand the context of a situation that you're in, it becomes harder and harder to have a really strong opinion about it. And you get to the point that you kind of can argue all sides, you know, and see what grievances are, and also kind of see why, while people ticked off about missed orders or shorted orders, or just kind of the principle of the thing, the principle of having one big distributor that exerts so much market control, that can all be legitimate at the same time that it's like that the company's serving this essential function. And as Joe Field said, it's like they're kind of doing an impossible job, and I don't remember his exact words, but it was something like, and they get it right most of the time or something like that. You know, they don't get it right a fair amount of the time, but they get it right most of the time.
I do think there's a contingent of people that thinks that competition will solve some of the problems, but I think your book is a handy tool to show that, you know, a particular kind of ruthless competition can bring its own problems with it.
Well, I almost wonder, I mean, one of the big what ifs of the business is, if you go back to that market bust in the 1990s, and if somehow we could have gotten through that in a way where both Capital City and Diamond survived, what would that have looked like? And even with the bust, because the bust was so bad that Diamond was not in great financial shape at that time either. The bust was so bad, everyone was really, really hurting. It's not inconceivable that the comics business could have gotten through that with two distributors and two substantial distributors. It ended up happening the way it did because of the major publishers all, you know, one by one were signing exclusive contracts with Diamond. It's an interesting what if, but the thing is, I really think that if you did have two big distributors today, or however many, you just more than one, I think a lot of the problems that you're having, you would still have, because a lot of these problems are inherent to to just the kind of the logistics and warehousing businesses. It's just this, just this is stuff that just happens. And I think that the more, as I see it, the more there's a more interesting argument to be made just about kind of comics as an art form and whether or not having one big distributor supports makes it so that interesting new stuff, does it make it easier or does it make it harder for stuff to find an audience? And I think what's happening a lot of times lately is that creators are finding their audiences on their own. It isn't like you just, and it's just the nature of a shift away from print in some ways, but you'll see artists that are doing web comics, that are doing, or that are just self-distributing, that are selling mini comics at Quimby's in Chicago or Desert Island in Brooklyn, and then eventually publishing longer form stuff. But it's like, is having one big distributor inhibiting that? I don't think so, but I think that's the more interesting, I don't know, that's what I find to be the more interesting question.
Dan, I could ask more questions, but now is the part of the interview segment where we're going to kick it over to our listeners on Twitter who have some questions for you. And if you want to get in on this action, it's easy to do. All you have to do is become an organized criminal, do crimes, shoot a Tommy gun, ride in an old-fashioned car, and then go work at a comic distribution warehouse, because apparently that happened. Read Dan's book if you want to learn more about that. Then sign up for an account on twitter.com. Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, the ISB, that's Chris, and wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific Time, and you can ask a question just like the ones you're about to hear for our guest, Dan Guarino. And we're going to start with this question from Greg Black on Twitter. He asks, how many comic shop customers do you expect will be crushed underneath their giant wall of Funko Pops? Which I think is a broader question about like toys and other merchandise in comic shops as opposed to comic books.
No, I think that's a very specific question about the very real threat of being murdered by those little nightmare monsters.
I'm fascinated by how well Funko has been able to sell this stuff. It's like, it's one of those things. It's something I just don't understand. There's so many shops that have sold so many of those things. And I'm curious. It's like, I want to do an ethnography of the Funko super fan, like the people who have a ton of these things, because I wonder, it seems to me unsustainable to have, to produce so many what is a Funko Pop called? Is it called a pop? What is the singular of a pop figure? I don't know.
Yeah, but, you could call it a figure.
But they're everywhere, and a lot of them. I mean, I look at them in the store in you know, comic shops, and I think, man, that looks kind of cool. But I've never been even remotely tempted to buy one. But yeah, but one of the things I understand is that there are those who buy, who have hundreds of them, and I just the display concerns would just be like, I don't even know how. There's clearly things I don't grasp here, but I find it interesting.
There was a Reddit post. Somebody posted their contract with their wife about only being able to spend $30 a week.
I saw that. It was the most horrifying thing I have seen in my life.
So I had two, and I'm wondering, can that be real?
I mean, I don't know. But it was full of exceptions. Like, all these convention weekends were accepted. And if they were buying the Funko Pop for somebody else, that was an exception. Like, it was full of loopholes.
Yeah, I feel like I would – see, what I would like to do, and if my reporting gig made it so that this was a story I could chase, I would like to verify the authenticity of that contract, because I got to tell you, That's setting off my spidey sense.
I do think it was a bit. Yeah. If only because the wife's signature was underlined concerned wife.
But you know, it could be kind of a bit, but also this guy maybe owns 500 of these things, or I don't even know if that's a lot. Like I don't know what, you know.
I mean, look, we're all reasonable people here. I think that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just thinking, and it kind of makes me imagine this kind of parallel world where I'm a Funko collector, and I just think, like, I think I'd get all the Legion of Superheroes in the various incarnations, and I'd get a couple. I can think of, I can't imagine going with 100 figures, though. I mean, at some point, the storage issues alone would be just too, you know, I guess you'd have to, like, box them up and just not have them on display. I don't know. But yeah. Yeah, somebody should, if I didn't think that Funko Pops and that whole, if I didn't think there was this kind of the whiff of a bubble with Funko products where I just wonder if they're going to be selling in these numbers 3 years from now, it would be interesting to, like, get into that world and figure out kind of who these buyers are and whether or not, I mean, I wonder if it's like, I mean, you know, you hear with guns that, like, this tiny percentage of the buyers own this gigantic share of the total number of products. You know, I wonder if it's like 10% of the Funko buyers own like 80% of the product or something like that. But
WC Wit on Twitter asks, what parts of comics retail do you think go underappreciated or underdiscussed?
The thing that I saw over and over again was the importance of kid sections for young readers at stores. One thing that almost all the best stores have in common is that they have a good section for young readers, and that they have recognized that there's a real renaissance underway in terms of high quality comics being published for kids. In a lot of ways, we're stuck in this stereotypical idea of what a comic shop is and who a comic shop audience is. But the very best stores, you'll see lots of families shopping. You'll see lots of kids shopping. You'll see all kinds of diversity. You'll see the gender breakdown is it's not this overwhelmingly male dominated audience as much at the better stores as it is as this kind of a stereotypical idea. But yeah, I would say that the one thing. The kids' comics are just exceptional right now, much more so than when I was a kid, and that should be an essential part of a good comic shop. It is for a lot of the really good comic shops.
Now it's time for Character Corner, the part of Twitter questions where fictional characters ask questions for our guest. This one comes from Lucky Jim Howlett at Lucky Jim 420. Lucky Jim wants to know, any tips to starting a comic shop, bub?
Well, okay, now first of all, I can't recognize Jim Howlett because any story involving that name is an atrocity. So I just don't so tips for starting a comic shop. And this is really boring, inspiring, but the number one tip is, you know, being what I call well capitalized. You know, just don't go on into it with enough money to get through 3 months and just hoping things will come together. You need to go into it with a plan that it might take a little while to build an audience. So make sure that you have enough money behind the project to have an adequate inventory to be able to open and on day one have a store that when people come in, they'll want to come back. So that's the number one thing. Way too many stores are undercapitalized, and a lot of good stores started and were lucky to survive for a couple of years. You know, they happened to be in a really good market or they were in a good neighborhood, but it's just tough. And the second thing would be just make sure to have a kid section, make sure to stock a kid section. And know a good kid section should be right to the right or right to the left of your front entrance so that you can't miss it. And develop, you know, and get to know local elementary schools near the store because, you know, donate age appropriate comics. Make it so that, you know, and inform because the, if kids are coming in your store, their parents are coming into the store too. And it's like they're all potential customers, and kids comics are so good, and kids are already reading comics. The comics, some of the top selling comics in this country are middle grade comics sold at Scholastic book fairs. So kids know this stuff. It's just a question of are they buying it at your store?
Here's a question from Stone Cold HCC, an account that exists only to ask questions on War Rocket Ajax. It's one of his classics. He wants to know, how come Urkel ain't on more shows? I'd watch him.
That's a very good question. And I think the problem is that there's a real limit to how much you can do with that character. And I think that you basically have seen him go about as far as he can. And if there were more shows, I think you would see increasingly ridiculous plot elements that would just have a real tough time sticking with audiences. But I mean,
Dan, I want to thank you for seriously answering that question with a thoughtful and perhaps very accurate answer.
I'm gonna add to that, Stone Cold. There's only one Urkel.
It's true,
unless we clone him, which may have happened on family at some point.
I don't think
there's actually four Urkels. there's Steve Urkel. There's Stefan Urkel. There's a robot, and then there's a third one that I don't remember.
Okay, the robot was different, but Steven and Stefan Urkel occupy the same body.
Yeah. Also, let's not forget, I mean, if we're talking about comedic actor Jaleel White, he does not have a problem playing multiple roles. You might be forgetting about Sonic Underground, in which he played Sonic the Hedgehog, and I believe Sonic the Hedgehog's two siblings who formed a band.
Whoa.
Thank you for that deep knowledge of Sonic cartoon lore, Chris. I appreciate it.
I just weirdly know a lot about the life and career of Jaleel White.
Well, that's good. That's good.
He's due for a critical reassessment at some point. We need to have, you know, this kind of round of articles written about how that show was underappreciated and was actually quite good. And I haven't seen it in a long time, so I don't know if it was actually quite good, but I bet a good writer could with a straight face talk about how, you know, that was not terrible.
Here's your title. The question is whether you call that article "Whatever Happened to Predictability" or "Days Go By." Those are your two choices. I think that's all we've got.
You could also say "Family Matters Matters."
That's true.
Yeah.
I think that's going to do it for us.
Dan, can you please let our listeners know where they can find you and your new book, should you wish to be found?
I have a website, and it's dangarino.com, and that's spelled dangarino.com. And then on Twitter, where you can see me tweet about the automotive industry and comics, I'm at Dan Garino.
Folks, our guest has been Dan Garino, obviously. The book is called Comic Shop, The Retail Mavericks Who Gave Us a New Geek Culture. And there's a foreword in there by Tom Spurgeon. So you know it's got a good stamp of approval. Dan, thank you so much for joining us on this week's show. You've been a delight.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to Dan Garino for joining us with a lot of insight on the business of comics that I worked in and have very little comprehension of.
And now it's time for us to talk about something that hopefully we have a lot of comprehension of. It's time for us to answer a question from our listeners. This, Chris, is a question from an anonymous person on Tumblr.
Oh, always a great source of questions, that.
This one is actually in reference to something we talked about a while back, where we talked about all the different comics covers that keep showing up, like the covers that get homaged over and over and over again,
like your JLI number ones, your Crisis Infinite Earth sevens, your Amazing Fantasy 15s, your Spider-Man 300s,
all covers that have been done and redone many times. Fantastic Four number one, that one's been redone several times. Their question is, are there any cover homages that you wish people would stop doing?
Most, if not all of them.
Well, okay, so there's the exception of JLI number one is that a lot of times that's Kevin Maguire doing it again.
That comic in particular is such a useful piece of shorthand. Like when they drop that cover on More Than Meets the Eye number one, it tells you what kind of book it is. it's going to be like a funny character-driven book that's also going to occasionally punch you in the heart.
Sure.
Just like JLI. But other than that, I genuinely think most cover homages are fine and they're fun, but they don't work out as well as doing a new cover would. You know, like doing a new cover and setting the tone for something else to homage would do.
I don't think you're wrong about that. I will say that sometimes they are effective. Like Spider-Man or Amazing Fantasy number 15, like as a way to debut a new Spider-Man costume, do Amazing Spider-Man 15 where he's wearing a different costume, or to debut somebody who is like a Spider-Man family sort of character, but and they're in that pose. Like, I think those can be effective.
I think they can be interesting. I mean, the one that springs to mind is, I mean, obviously there's the first black costume appearance. There's the What If story where he's got six arms.
There's the Deadpool issue.
Deadpool 10. Yeah. Where Deadpool literally goes back to a 60s issue of Spider-Man. But even with that Deadpool issue, wouldn't it have made more sense for that to be the cover of that issue of Amazing Spider-Man instead of Amazing Fantasy number one?
But I mean, I would say probably people don't recognize that cover of Amazing Spider-Man. The ones that bug me are the ones that are like, they don't show an action. It's just a pose and you're just redrawing the pose.
Yeah.
The one that makes me, there are a couple. I think I could live with never seeing another homage to Crisis number 7.
Yeah, I could pretty happily live without that.
And I could live with never seeing another reinterpretation of the Todd McFarlane Spider-Man number 1.
Which are usually done by Todd McFarlane.
Well, there's the one where he has the black costume. I think that's actually Spider-Man number 13. So it took him like 13 issues to do the same cover again.
Yeah, and he's done it with Spawn too.
Yeah.
Which I actually think is fun. I will say, anytime an artist, and you know, whether it's Kevin Maguire, Todd McFarlane, Rob's done it a couple times, anytime that an artist homages their own cover, I will make an exception because I think that's a baller move. And Rob even, I forget what it was. It might have been Todd, actually. You know how it's like, you know, such and such after Perez or such and such after Cockrum. Todd McFarlane, I think, I can't remember if it was Todd or Rob, did After Me, which is just the most baller move that you can pull off. You know, to put my money where my mouth is just a little bit, like we thought about maybe doing a giant size X-Men number 1 homage when we were doing 92. And we didn't, because it's been done.
Yeah.
And we ended up doing the kind of, like, you know, the cover that was the – not quite an X-Men 100 homage, but it's that good guys running at bad guys imagery that is similar to but legally distinct from what you see in the intro to the 92 animated series.
Right.
But, I mean – that wasn't a direct homage so much as it was a direct cover homage, I should say, so much as it was another way to kind of convey the content to the reader.
Here's what I'll end up saying kind of as my take on doing cover homages. I think they're fine. Like, there's a couple that I would be fine never seeing again. They're better if they're additive. If they're recognizably an homage to a previous cover, but you add something to them so that you're telling a new story. Because if you look at the cover of Amazing Spider-Man 252, it's not just Amazing Fantasy 15 again. It's the same pose. He's in a different costume, but also he's not just kind of like holding the one guy, you know, to take him to justice. He's like swinging sort of recklessly with these two people hanging off his arms, and one guy is about to fall. Which means there's something different about this Spider-Man, right? There's something different about Spider-Man in this costume. Mm-hmm. It's telling you something. And if you can figure out a way to do the homage and have it tell a new story or show that this is a different version of this character that you all know and you remember from this old cover, then it's much better in that regard.
I will say I could do without most of them, but I will make exceptions for like fun. Cause you know, I do think the big Image 25th anniversary celebration from last year, where all the Image books did homage covers for other Image books, I thought was very, very fun. But mostly like a lot of times, I'll tell you like flat out, Amazing Spider-Man 129, the first Punisher, never need to see that homaged again. There's so many.
All right. I think we answered the question. If you would like to send us a question, you can do so by heading over to our Tumblr, warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com, or you can send us an email at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, check us out on Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a review there. The more good reviews we get, the more we are featured, which helps us out. 5 stars would be great. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. I've tried to make it extremely easy. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you will find links to all my stuff, including Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective on Comixology. It's all back there. As of this week, this Wednesday, issue 8 will be up, which means every extant issue of Copernicus Jones, Robot Detective will be available once again on Comixology. It's been a rough time, but they're all back now. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find my stuff by going to the-isb.com. That is my website. Which has links to all the comics that I write, the columns that I write around the web, like the weekly That's What's Up column at Looper, where I answer your questions every single Friday. Please send me some questions because I can always use more. Hit me up on Twitter at the ISB with the tag What's Up Chris. You can also find my comics at your local comic book shop or on Amazon, stuff like X-Men 92, Deadpool, Bad Blood, Ash vs. Army of Darkness, Sword Quest, which I was very, very proud of from this past year. All kinds of good fun. Dark Hawk, very recent. Hey, if you are in the North Carolina area or the South Carolina area, or you're anywhere near Charlotte, North Carolina, on the 27th of January, that is this coming Saturday, Matt and I will both be at Charlotte Minicon. That is the nice little one-day show put on by Heroes Aren't Hard to Find. You can find information about that just by searching for Charlotte Minicon. But I'll be there. Chad will be there. Matt, you'll be there. There's always a bunch of good people. I think the other Matt Wilson is going to be there too, so that's fun.
There's so many Matt Wilsons that will be at that show. We're both listed on the website. Matt Wilson, colorist. Matt D. Wilson, writer.
That's you. But yeah, that's gonna wrap us up. Matt, before we get out of here, I believe we do have a cause of the week.
That's right. We are sending everybody here at the first of the year to go help out the Hero Initiative. You most likely know what the Hero Initiative is all about. It helps comic creators who are in need, who might have medical needs, or who are otherwise falling on hard times, which is something that happens way more often than it should. As a comic-centric show, we definitely want to point people to that. If you feel like donating to the Hero Initiative, it would be a good place to send your time and attention. So go check them out. They are at heroinitiative.org, and you can find all their information.
Definitely a cause worth supporting for helping out some of the great creators of past times. Matt, that does it for War Rocket Ajax number 386. We'll be back next week. My voice will not be this sexy, everybody. But for now, how did we do, Matt?
By all means, I want to hear it in your deep, deep voice.
Well, just forward me the email that you got from the Podcasting Commission.
All right, here we go. I just forwarded it from the Podcasting Commission's upper council.
All right, I'm refreshing. Okay, here it is. Here it is. It says Ajax 86 live recording status update. We've got two categories here. Looks like they've both got green check marks. Two areas here with check marks by them. The first one says HQC, and the second is S rank.
Hell yeah!
Oh hell yeah!
Give me a hell yeah!
Have a great week, everybody.
We love you.
Yeah. Flash.